WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Pain is often more than just the physical hurt. It can create fear and emotional suffering. My guest, Dr. Scott Fishman, is the author of a new book about the latest techniques for treating pain. It's called The War on Pain. Dr. Fishman is the chief of the Division of Pain Medicine at the University of California, Davis. He's the former director of the Massachusetts General Hospital Pain Center. I asked him, what is pain?
Well, that question goes to the very heart of why we have pain specialists, because pain is almost impossible to define. We've been trying to define it for thousands of years, and those of us who specialize in treating pain have come to the understanding that pain is ultimately what the patient says it is. That's the guiding definition that most of us follow.
What does that mean, and how is that useful?
Well, it means that when somebody comes to me or goes to another physician or complains of pain in general, we believe them, and I always assume that someone is suffering from something. The problem with pain is that it's intrinsically subjective. And when one person says they have pain, they may have a completely different experience than another person who says they have pain, even though they may say their pain is just as severe. So when someone complains of pain, it may mean that they are feeling a sharp stabbing sensation, whereas another person might mean that they're missing a loved one.
What function does physical pain serve?
Physical pain has an important function, and life is not a very high quality if we don't have a pain system, because the pain system serves as our alarm. It's our sensor to the outside world that tells us that we have impending danger or have been harmed. And it gives us an advantage of being able to potentially react and preclude any further damage or avoid damage from happening to us. So if we are getting close to a stove, we may feel a burning sensation, we may pull back, and that's why we all have that kind of reflex. If we didn't have our pain sensors or pain nerves, and there are actually people who are born genetically without pain sensors, they tend to have really serious injuries because they're not able to modulate the world around them, and they get burned, they get injured, they wind up actually losing limbs sometimes. Life is not a comfortable place without a pain alarm. The problem is when that alarm gets over-triggered and then loses its purpose.
Chronic pain.
Either chronic pain or pain that has even in fact, the pain of childbirth. Now, some people might argue that that does have a purpose, but for someone who is in the midst of severe suffering, I would argue that the pain of childbirth has really potentially lost its evolutionary role in that in primitive times, the pain of childbirth would force you to stop what you're doing and take heed to the event that's occurring. In modern times, we're already taking heed and we're controlling the situation. So further suffering may be interpreted as unnecessary. And I think there are many women in the world who would testify that turning that alarm off at that time is a real blessing.
Now, a lot of common pain is caused by inflammation. Why do pain and inflammation go hand in hand?
Well, because inflammation, pain occurs at the time of injury or impending injury. And when injury occurs, the healing process is enlisted. And that healing, the first step of that healing process is inflammation. Inflammation is really the biological phenomena of rushing in all the different kinds of cells that we need to not only start healing, but continue to protect an area. So, for example, if one were to bump their elbow, the elbow might swell if it was a severe enough bump. And that swelling would serve to do a bunch of different things. One would be to start the healing process in case blood vessels were broken or tissues were damaged. And it would do so by bringing in white cells that would fight off bacteria and other what we call inflammatory mediators. The secondary function is going to be to sensitize the tissues so that that elbow might remain sore. And the purpose of the elbow remaining sore is that the threshold for it to elicit pain is decreased. And anybody knows this intuitively, that when we have an injury, we tend to protect it. And that protection is the purpose of the link between inflammation and pain.
There's some inflammation that isn't helpful at all, like arthritis.
With arthritis, you have an underlying process of joints being constantly injured by the disease of arthritis. Typically, in osteoarthritis, it's an inflammatory process, and that process is stimulating the normal system to ring out its alarm because damage is occurring. And so we try to treat arthritis by two different mechanisms. One is to reduce the inflammation and treat the pain by that mechanism. But now a very promising way to treat the pain is to treat the underlying disease and slow down that process of inflammation. So there are now new medications that really go at the heart of arthritis and are slowing down the actual effects on the joints before the pain occurs.
What drugs are those?
Well, there are numerous drugs, and I won't go into detail on them with their names, but there are different drugs that decrease the cell turnover that occur in the joints themselves.
Mm-hmm. There's a new class of anti-inflammatories that operate differently than, say, aspirin or ibuprofen. And we've seen advertisements for a lot of these all the time on TV. Celebrex and Vioxx are two of these new anti-inflammatories. What are they, and how are they different from drugs like Tylenol and Advil and Motrin?
Well, I'll start off answering that by talking about the more standard drugs like ibuprofen, aspirin, and Tylenol. These are drugs that have been exquisitely successfully used for managing all sorts of pain by consumers around the world, and all you need to do is walk through the analgesic section of any drugstore to see how many choices there are in these this different class of drugs. They're thought to be very safe, and they're safe enough to be over the counter. However, even these drugs, when used in too high doses or for too long a period of time, can have serious side effects, and even side effects that can be life-threatening. The big side effects for drugs like aspirin or ibuprofen is that they cause ulcers and they cause bleeding problems. And that is what has been addressed with this new class of drug, which is very much like a ibuprofen-type drug or an Advil-type drug without the propensity to cause ulcers or bleeding problems.
So how do they function in your body? Maybe you could give us a layman's explanation. Sure. Of how they manage to reduce the swelling without causing the ulcers.
Well, the COX-2 refers to the cyclooxygenase type 2 enzyme. Enzymes are mediators of reactions in the body. And what these drugs do is they block the enzyme. The enzymes required for the process of inflammation as well as generation of pain. So when we block the enzyme, we can help block pain. The problem is that the enzyme does other things other than causing pain. And in the stomach and on the platelets within the blood, the enzyme has a vital role of protecting the stomach and in maintaining our ability to clot our blood. So when we go to block the enzyme either in the spinal cord or in the elbow or wherever we're feeling our pain, we simultaneously block it in the stomach and in the blood when we use medicines like ibuprofen. The safety factor for the COX-2 inhibitors, and what's really brilliant about these drugs, is that the developers were able to find out that the enzyme in the stomach and in the blood is slightly different than the one that may modulate, may be involved with inflammation and with pain. So they've been able to select out just that enzyme so that the new drugs only block the enzymes that we think are involved with pain and don't block the enzymes in the stomach or the blood, thus allowing for normal stomach function and normal bleeding function. The problem with them is that the enzyme that's involved with pain and inflammation is also an enzyme that is in the kidney. So it's something that we watch chronically. Any of these drugs, including ibuprofen, aspirin, or the new COX-2 products like Vioxx or Celebrex, can cause some problems with the kidneys long term. So it's something that we watch closely.
These new anti-inflammatories are very new. How much do we know about the long-term effects? How much do we know about what the side effects are if you're using it for chronic pain?
Well, it's a good question. With any of these new drugs, we really don't have a long historical view of what they do, but they do appear to be safe, and they've undergone very, very rigorous testing initially in animals and then in humans. FDA really puts them through their paces to make sure that they're safe. So they look pretty safe, but as your question implies, you never know until they're time-tested.
And what are they mostly being prescribed for?
Well, they're being prescribed for a lot of different things, primarily for arthritis kind of pain, but we're now using them for all kinds of chronic pains across the board, from pain that's related to different tissue damages to pain that's related to nerve damage. We're using them in any patient that really has a high risk of either ulcer formation or particularly bleeding problems.
My guest is pain specialist Dr. Scott Fishman, author of the new book, The War on Pain. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Scott Fishman. He's chief of the Division of Pain Medicine at the University of California at Davis, and he's the author of the new book, The War on Pain. Why is chronic pain often so difficult to treat?
Well, the problem with chronic pain, as I said before, it's pain that has lost its real purpose. It's the alarm system gone awry, and it's pain that has lasted beyond a reasonable period of healing. The problem with that is that it doesn't make sense, and it's not serving a purpose. So it's essentially a problem in the body that's become intractable. And as we said before about the definition of pain being so difficult to define for every individual, over time, pain has different meanings for different people. You can't have pain without a mind, so it's always a mind-body phenomenon. And because of that, it becomes very individualized. It's hard to have cookie-cutter solutions, and it requires really looking at people's bodies and their minds and their lives.
Well, we'll get to the mind and pain some more in a bit. You describe lower back pain as being particularly problematic, and for anybody who's had lower back pain, they know that's true. Why is lower back pain very difficult to treat?
Well, you know, if you look at the statistics on low back pain, it's hard to treat, but for most of us, it comes and goes and isn't a big problem in our lives. For others of us, low back pain can become intractable and can really limit our ability to get on with our lives, if not enjoy our lives. It's difficult to treat back pain because we've not understood it in its entirety. And we probably don't understand it completely now, but we understand it better than ever. In fact, now when someone has an acute flare-up of low back pain, we no longer send them directly to bed. We know that it's best for them to do the activities that they can do that don't cause pain without ceasing their function. And we also make sure that they don't overdo it as well, because they can further injure their back. So we don't throw people also into aggressive physical therapy anymore. So we're coming to understand the balance of how the body heals once the back has become inflamed or otherwise irritated. The back has a multitude of different reasons to cause pain, which really reflects the incredible organ that the spine is. The spine does an amazing job in terms of being able to make our bodies flexible and move with ease, despite carrying an enormous amount of weight on it and force. So as we get older, the back starts to wear, and as it wears, the pain signals, the pain fibers are triggered. And for most of us, we're able to manage that. But for some of us, that wear and tear causes pain that just doesn't stop. And for those kinds of patients, we take what we call a regional approach, where we look at the spine and look at the areas that can cause the pain. And kind of like a Columbo-type medical detective, we step-by-step look for the common suspects, rule out those who aren't involved, and go after the nerves that might be involved and help target treatments that go right to the point of pain. These are treatments like epidural injections or nerve root injections or other kinds of joint injections in the back that either use steroids to block inflammation and pain or local anesthetics to turn off the nerves that may be inflamed. There's something about turning the signal off that allows the body to heal, and we really try to rely on that as much as we can.
Now, I know for some people who have back pain, they have these little, like little vibrators put on their back, and it kind of like goes back and forth on your back, just kind of like tapping it a lot, is my understanding. And is the goal of that to distract you from the other pain?
Well, this is something called TENS. It's a TENS unit, and essentially it delivers a little bit of an electrical shock to the skin.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably, we don't know exactly how it works, and it doesn't work for everybody, but for some, they feel that it makes an enormous amount of difference. And what it does is it provides a bit of sensation to the nervous system that is not necessarily noxious or painful. But that signal, when it reaches the spinal cord, can crowd out the pain signal that's coming in. And this is probably no different than what we're doing with products like Icy Hot or Bengay, something what I would call a counter irritant, which substitutes a sensation that is bearable for one that isn't bearable. It's based on the idea that the central nervous system or the spine can only take so much sensation in at once. And if you crowd it with sensations that are bearable, the ones that aren't won't get through. This is probably also the reason why if you bang your shoulder, even before you know your shoulder's banged, your arm may go to it and you may be rubbing your skin. Or when you cut yourself, you may want to touch the skin, and that makes it feel better. This is a very interesting area for us because there's a new technology that we're using that takes us one step further, or one step really inward. It's a technology called spinal cord stimulation, where we take a very fine filament and place it just like an epidural catheter, really the same way that we'd place an epidural catheter for temporary pain relief for a pregnant woman, into the spinal cord area, in an area called the epidural space, and we deliver a tiny little charge just like the one that we would use on the skin, but this is directly at the level of the spinal cord. It's barely perceptible for the patient, but it's enough to crowd out the pain. And this has become a very, very successful technique for treating chronic low back pain or chronic pains in other areas of the body for certain conditions.
My guest is Dr. Scott Fishman, and he's written a new book called The War on Pain. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Scott Fishman. He's chief of the Division of Pain Medicine at the University of California at Davis and the author of the new book, The War on Pain. You say in your book that some patients say, don't try to dismiss my pain by saying the pain is in my mind. I really feel this. Well, you point out the pain is in your mind, that it's the mind that processes the reaction that we describe as pain. Therefore, are you more optimistic about ways of using mind-body therapy to deal with pain?
Well, I would say my patients' worst fear, and probably their worst fear when they see any of their doctors, is that their doctor is going to tell them that their pain is all in their mind. And the problem with that is the misconception that if we consider the mind, we're implying to the patient that they're somehow a crock, or we don't believe them. Whereas I would argue just the opposite, that as you mentioned, you can't have pain without a mind. If we're going to treat the most difficult problems with chronic pain, we're not going to be successful unless we consider the full entity of the pain, and that always includes the mind. I'm not suggesting that everyone with pain needs psychotherapy or psychological intervention. In fact, many patients do not, and I'm able to very successfully treat pain with just physical modalities. But when pain exceeds those kinds of treatments, I think it always requires looking at it in what I would call a holistic manner in terms of that interface between the mind and body, to look at all of the factors that may be impacting pain.
Have you worked with treatments like acupuncture, hypnosis, biofeedback, relaxation techniques to deal with pain?
We have, and I have, and we continue to in our program and many other wonderful programs throughout the country. The issue with the mind and body is that each of us, I think, knows from watching television and other experiences that people have done incredible things with their mind in terms of blocking pain. We've all seen athletes who have played the end of a championship game with a broken leg, mothers who have lifted cars off of children, and people who have done superhuman Ironman triathlons by psyching themselves out. And what that implies is that intrinsically we have enormous pain-relieving properties that we can harness. And that's what our therapies try to do. The opposite is also true, that our intrinsic properties can also magnify pain and make pain worse, particularly when pain has become chronic and is around for a long time. It's kind of like the stereo being turned up louder and louder. And what we try to do is turn that volume down using our own intrinsic healing processes that have been exceptionally well harnessed through modalities like hypnosis and biofeedback, guided imagery, meditation. We really don't know how therapies like acupuncture work, but acupuncture appears to be exceptionally safe. So when the therapy appears to be effective and is safe, while I would like to know how it works, that's not a requirement for using it. So we also use therapies like acupuncture for these cases.
Are there any of these alternative therapies that you have found to be particularly effective in pain, or do you think it really depends on who the person is and what the pain is?
Well, it depends on the person, and I think to be able to harness one's internal pain-relieving properties, you have to want to, and not everybody wants to. One of the problems is that patients often fear that if they do allow these psychological techniques to help them feel better, it will imply that they were a crock, or it will mean on some level that their pain wasn't real. So they may be hesitant on some level to engage in them. I think anybody who's willing to can benefit from these therapies, because there's no question that we have a lot of control over how much we sense.
What is the new thing on the horizon that you're most looking forward to now in pain relief?
Well, there are too many new things to just pick out one, but there are many new receptor systems that have been discovered that are going to now help us much more specifically to target pain treatments to exactly the nerves that we need the medicines to go to. There are better treatments that will have less side effects. There are treatments that will help us not use drugs, but to use other things like these spinal cord stimulators. There are drug delivery systems that are going to allow us to give medications without using needles or injections. There are exciting therapies like inhaled morphine-type therapies, modalities that drive medicines right through the skin with an electrical charge so that one doesn't even have to take pills. All sorts of exciting therapies. And then there's very, very exciting work going on in terms of understanding how to undo the knot of chronic pain on a patient's quality of life in terms of psychological approaches. And this will really bear greatly on treatment successes in the future.
Dr. Scott Fishman, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Dr. Scott Fishman is the author of The War on Pain and chief of the Division of Pain Medicine at the University of California, Davis. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with music from a new CD by composer and soprano saxophonist Philip Johnston, who is, among other things, the co-founder of the Microscopic Septet, which performs our theme. This is the title track from his new CD, The Merry Frolics of Satan.